I'm Paul Kennedy with an ideas show featuring the 2005 Multiculturalism Lecture from the Chan Center on the campus of the University of British Columbia. Tonight, Governor General's award-winning poet, Roy Meakey, speaks about redress. We'll learn that Roy Meakey had another life as a member of the negotiation committee of the National Association of Japanese Canadians. He helped to negotiate a redress agreement with the federal government in September of 1988. Here with the 2005 Multiculturalism Lecture is Roy Meakey.
Thank you, thank you. It's awesome to be here. I'd like to say how honored I am to give this year's UBC Laurier Institution Multiculturalism Lecture, which is presented by the CBC. My lecture tonight is entitled Redress, Dealing with Past Injustices. The lecture explores the personal and social implications of the Japanese-Canadian redress movement and the settlement. And I'd like to begin with a short poem that I hope will strike a chord for my remarks this evening. And it's called A Primer, in memory of my father, who died 2 decades before redress. Prime the engine, my father used to say. And sure enough, it started. But prime too much, it would flood. The smell of gasoline in a stalled time. And by the way, he would add, don't forget the primer, or the paint won't bind. He knew about machines and about relationships. Before the World Trade Center was bombed in the catastrophic event now called 9/11, the advocates of globalization often praised economic globalization as an example of capitalism at its finest moment. But after 9/11, such hype around the expansion of global processes was eclipsed by the language of terrorism, the major thrust of the powerful USA Patriot Act that was passed in the month following. Overnight, a nation that had been so intent on globalizing itself retreated to a fundamental nationalism, best exemplified in President Bush's injunction, "You're either with us or against us." Overnight as well, the world shrank into a we-they syndrome of violent opposition, and the borders between the U.S. and everyone else turned into uneasy zones of interrogation, surveillance, and militarism. Instead of adopting an international strategy built on negotiations and without the support of the United Nations, the U.S. government initiated a preemptive invasion of Iraq. In effect, the U.S. violated the principle of acknowledging the sovereignty of nations and of not resorting to war unless attacked. Very soon, the language of terrorism was normalized as the everyday medium of the Bush administration's assumptions, policies, and actions. Heightened security measures in the United States have generated new anxieties in global relations, the results of which remain uncertain, unpredictable, and always potentially volatile. Perhaps we are even witnessing the rippling effects of U.S. policy in recent protests in China and elsewhere, protests that call on the Japanese government to redress the brutal acts of torture, rape, and murder carried out in its name during the 1930s and 1940s. If history and its discontents are still very much alive, then such calls for redress may intensify rather than abate in the years ahead. I am thinking here of the Canadian government's failure thus far to resolve the injustices endured by Indigenous persons through its residential school system. I am thinking of Charlie Kwan in his late 90s, one of the last surviving head taxpayers who has already waited 20 years for redress. I am thinking of the heroic 82-year-old Gim Wong, now on his cross-Canada motorcycle journey, destination Ottawa, to bring closure to the head tax issue. His democratic activism shows, to cite a news article, that it is never too late to put right an injustice. Memories of past injustices have a way of resisting the passage of time. This persistence of calls for redress was not predictable back on September 22, 1988. On that day, Japanese Canadians, as represented by the National Association of Japanese Canadians, the NAJC, signed a redress agreement with the federal government. The agreement offered the long-awaited acknowledgement of the injustices of the 1940s, along with individual and community compensation, pardons for those wrongfully convicted, citizenship for those who had been deported, and a public foundation to fight racism, eventually established as the Canadian Race Relations Foundation. In actuality, it was a month before, on August the 25th, that the NAJC's negotiation committee, of which I was a member, had negotiated the agreement with Jerry Weiner, the multiculturalism minister, in a Montreal hotel room. We had to wait, agonizingly at times, for a break in the House of Commons agenda. As it turned out, there were few openings because of the debates raging over the impending free trade agreement with the United States. An unexpected hiatus occurred on September 22nd, and the government quickly acted to announce that a settlement had been concluded with the Japanese Canadians whose citizenship rights had been violated. And clearly, the redress agreement signified an affirmation of citizenship rights. And the Japanese Canadians' redress were portrayed as citizens who were wronged by the racist policies and actions of the Canadian state. But in a strange twist, perhaps not so strange anymore, the language of citizenship, which had been so crucial in shaping the Canadian nation in the post-war decades, was being drained of its potency by the language of economic globalization. A year later, in November 1989, the Berlin Wall collapsed, and voices celebrated the end of the Cold War era, an era defined by the ideological warfare between the capitalist USA and the communist USSR. It was also an era in which national governments, including Canada's, had managed and insulated its citizens through top-down state policies and institutions that protected the nation's sovereignty. These same citizens, according to the emergent corporate language, were now free to enjoy all the unfolding pleasures of commodity capitalism. Who needed the nation when we could all be consumers in the border-crossing marketplaces of the globe? For Canadians who had been accustomed to state promotion of nationalism, the perceived loss of sovereignty generated alarm and even a sense of gloom and doom. Nowhere was the public heat more intense than in the disputes around the issue of the Free Trade Agreement, the FTA. Canadian nationalists saw this economic agreement with the United States as a direct threat to the nation's cultural identity. For these nations, the FTA translated into an invasion of Canadian social, economic, and cultural spaces by transnational corporations, primarily U.S.-controlled, that brought under their wings a consumerist-driven mass culture. Alongside this crisis, and perhaps in tandem with it, the language of multiculturalism had shifted significantly. The earlier attention to the folkloric elements of ethnicity, what critics described as its song and dance phase, was replaced by attention to anti-racist policies, which was exemplified, for instance, in the report called Equality Now, the 1984 All-Party Report that recommended a whole complex of measures to deal with systemic racism in Canadian institutions, including redress for Japanese Canadians. Here, in the intersection of the free trade agreement controversy and the changing meaning of multiculturalism, we could see that the state was moving away from the Cold War preoccupation with national identity towards a major involvement in global economic initiatives well beyond the nation's borders. There was an immediate need to mediate or otherwise diffuse the racism of its increasingly anxious white mainstream, whose former Canadian nation was apparently being deconstructed by the influx of foreign capital, not only from the United States, but from various Asian countries as well. Heightened racism within could very well have led to pressures by its increasingly nervous citizens to tighten the state's economic and social borders, a move that would have prohibited the flow of transnational capital into Canada's economy. The Japanese-Canadian redress movement thus took shape in what could only be described as a precarious condition. On the one hand, the values of citizenship were being reaffirmed at a time that the power of citizenship was being eroded by globalization. On the other hand, as the post-war nation was changing because of substantial demographic shifts in its population, including the arrival of non-white immigrants in large numbers, there was a political urgency to represent Canada in global contexts as a liberal nation that had redeemed its racist past. It was in the spaces between these two processes that redress came to prominence as a national drama. A drama through which Japanese Canadians would themselves have to renegotiate their troubled and troubling relationship to the nation that had interned them. My own awareness of past injustices took shape in the immediacy of internment stories, stories of tearful displacements and losses that were framed by government policies that had identified my family as enemy alien. This was the term applied to those that the government designated as of the Japanese race, the largest majority of whom happened to be Canadian. For the thousands of individuals who could not be unqualified Canadians but came to adopt a fill-in-the-blank modifier, such as in my case, Japanese Canadian, the connection to the nation called Canada always reminded them that they were socially marked as different. And this condition of being marked, it needs to be emphasized, became attached to the body, very much like a shadow, there even when it is not visible. While growing up, I often ruminated on the meaning of what I considered to be a cumbersome identity formation. Why did Japanese Canadian situate me and my family in a net of associations over which we seemed to have little control? Why both Japanese and Canadian? And what was this phenomenon called racism? And who was the Jap that prompted such negative reactions from the whites all around us, the so-called, quote, Hakujin, who appeared to have the deck always stacked in their favor? Coming to consciousness in post-war Winnipeg, where my family resettled, these were haunting questions. I have been intrigued by one particular sentence in Joy Kogawa's novel Obasan, the first novel of the internment. Its narrator, Naomi Nakane, nervously faces her Aunt Emily's diary that documents, in the daily fears of the time, the expulsion of Japanese Canadians from their West Coast homes and communities. While composing Aunt Emily's text, Kogawa herself had drawn from the astonishing series of letters that Muriel Kitagawa had written to her brother Wes Fujiwara in Toronto. Kitagawa's letters, which were published in This Is My Own over a decade after her death in 1974, begin in December 1941 and cascade like a rushing river through the days of violation and uprooting until May 1942. That month, assisted by Wes, she and her husband Ed Kitagawa, a beloved member of the legendary Asahi baseball team, were able to relocate to Toronto. They had four young children, two of whom were twins born in the midst of the upheaval. Shortly after the Penguin edition of Obasan appeared in 1983, and in the early phase of the redress movement, I undertook a research project on Kitagawa. I studied her papers in Ottawa's National Archives, and from that point of departure, immersed myself in the voluminous body of documents related to Japanese-Canadian internment, a process that took some 18 months. Through the lens of Muriel's writing, I got swept up in the still-swirling vortex of the past. I can remember vividly the hair-raising moment of discovering one document that drew me deep into the pain of dispersal. Wes and I were rummaging through some old boxes when we came across a thin notebook hidden away in a folder, its paper brittle from age. At first glance, the notebook looked blank, but there on one page, scribbled down in faint pencil, was Muriel's response to departure. She perhaps planned to keep a journal on the train, but aside from a brief remark on the page following, she did not record anything else. Muriel's words would open up my editorial introduction to This Is My Own, and I quote, "Monday evening, we left Vancouver 7:35 p.m. Gosh, but a lot of folks were there to see us off. The Yamadas, Toyofukus, Eiko, Yaiko, Nori, Hide, Nico, and Frank, Tom, Eiji Yatabe, Jim Suzuki, Harold, Mrs. Nakamura, Mr. Mori, Dr. Nomura, Mr. Hodson, the Miyakis, the Miyasakis, Ishiwaras, Katsukakes, Mio Ishiwata. I had the queerest sensation of living in some fantastic dream as the train slowly moved out of the station. All along the tracks, wherever they could, crowds of Nihonjin lined up to wave goodbye to those going to work camps, to Schreiber and to beet fields, ghost towns and other places. They waved to us and we waved to them, whoever they were. Some we knew, some we didn't. But weren't we all in the same boat, forced to move out of the restricted area? I hated the thought of leaving Eiko behind, so I blew her a gentle kiss. While researching the life and times of Mirio Kitagawa, the boundaries of my own family's history expanded, and the concept of redress became a horizon of new possibilities. Perhaps it was possible to transform the past. Here, I can now turn to the sentence from Obasan. Naomi says, and I quote, "I feel like a burglar when I read Aunt Emily's diary, breaking into a private house, only to discover it's my childhood house, filled with corners and rooms I've never seen," unquote. Obasan was published over 2 decades ago. Japanese-Canadian redress has been absorbed into a past that appears distant to the present generation. Reimagining a time period when the familiarity of my own family's history became strange to me is, of course, a slippery process. Still, as I recall, the act of feeling like a burglar captured the key moment of double consciousness that I have associated with the imagination's capacity to enter into contradictions and to create new dimensions of what had formerly seemed static and irreversible. Broken Entries was the way I thought of this process when I discovered the title to a book of essays. Didn't my grandparents and their Issei generation do the same when they entered a country that restricted their ability to exercise their democratic rights? Wasn't their determination to reinvent themselves in a new place, despite disenfranchisement and rampant racism, proof of the power of their imaginations? For me, encountering what had been covered over or silenced became a process of making visible the incarcerated gaps in Japanese-Canadian history. Gaps that contained the nodes of traumatic residue that called out for justice. Japanese-Canadians, I soon learned, had a knotted and deeply conflicted relationship to the past. Those of us who first campaigned to seek redress had first to enter the private house of Japanese-Canadians, and in there, the emotional and psychological effects of internment were very much alive.
I'm Paul Kennedy. Tonight on Ideas, the 2005 Multiculturalism Lecture from the Chan Center on the campus of the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. The lecturer is the prominent Japanese-Canadian poet, Roy Miki. Part of the live event in the Chan Center was an operatic version of Joy Kagawa's novel, Naomi's Road. It's the dramatic tale of a Japanese-Canadian family and their journey from Vancouver to an internment camp, and it's told from the perspective of 9-year-old Naomi.
Boogeyman?
No, he's not.
Well, he's got an evil eye. letter to you, yeah, for your brother. Can he play one of those?
He can play piano, but our piano, it's in Vancouver.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, goodbye.
Wait.
Soprano Jessica Chung and mezzo-soprano Grace Chan singing part of Naomi's Road, commissioned by Vancouver Opera and based on Joy Kagawa's novel for young readers, recounting the story of one Japanese-Canadian family's journey from Vancouver to an internment camp during World War II. You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1. I'm Paul Kennedy. Now back to Roy Meakey, the 2005 Multiculturalism Lecturer. He's speaking at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts at the University of British Columbia.
In my childhood, the vision of a history haunted by gaps was made the most tangible for me in the absence of our family photo albums. They had been placed in a trunk, along with other valuable keepsakes, to be saved until the family could return to their home in Haney, B.C. The trunk, they would be informed, was auctioned at one of several public auctions where the personal belongings of Japanese Canadians were sold for pitifully low sums, often a few dollars for a trunk full of family heirlooms. Tales of personal losses seeped into all the nooks and crannies of my childhood. But nowhere was the sense of estrangement more acute, at least to my young ears, in one story my father told me many times. Every kid loves a ghost story. My father lived in Nihonmachi, or Japantown, the area around Powell and Alexander Streets in Vancouver. One dark and stormy summer night, yes, it had to be dark and stormy, a friend from the Fraser Valley who couldn't return home decided to stay in the Powell Street Hotel. But all the rooms were booked, except the one that was normally left empty. Rumors circulated in the community that it was haunted by a young woman murdered by her lover. Not suspicious at all, in fact, scoffing at the belief in ghosts, my father's friend rented the room. Well, not unexpectedly, since this is a ghost story, he was awoken in the middle of the night by moaning sounds. There in the smoked glass of the door appeared the figure of a woman with long black hair crying out to him for help. When the figure disappeared, he fled the hotel. The kicker, my father said, and this has always stuck with me, the ghost disappeared with the community when Nihonmachi was dismantled in the mass uprooting of 1942. A version of that story came to me in a poem first written in the early 1970s. It invoked an old Japanese-Canadian Issei woman who used to wander the streets and back lanes of our central Winnipeg neighborhood. She talked to herself in Japanese, and in her rambling speech, she hunted for signposts of her lost Vancouver community. Like the ghost in my father's story, she became an emblem of the internal effects of internment. I had recently moved to Vancouver, and as I wandered the Powell Street area, as I often did at the time, she appeared in my imagination, for me a premonition of the redress movement on the horizon. It was published, this poem, much later in Saving Face. From Sansei Poem. At any time she was there, her face pressed like a flower against the glass of the front door. We hid behind the curtains. Or when we expected her on the edge of the stair just inside the door, or the dark of the house did not satisfy her, and she circled around to the back. When this too failed, she broke off and swung into the streets, again mouthing what she couldn't walk on. They preceded her incessantly. And those times we met her, outside, as we often did, nothing could stop her from trailing us home. At first, many Japanese Canadians shied away from public meetings on redress. There was the anxiety of being visible, of being perceived as other, and even of a racist backlash. Redress awakened memories of a past that had not been put to rest. When their surfaces were rubbed, even in casual conversations, individuals relived the scenes of uprooting and dispossession, once again unable to resolve the violations they had to endure. To be Japanese Canadian was to inhabit a consciousness that was divided by an internal contradiction. While Canadian invoked the security of citizenship rights, belonging, and democratic forms of governance, Japanese conjured the ghost of enemy alien, an identity that had been condemned to the dark underside of the nation, where they had been deprived of voice and the power to defend themselves. The redress movement was multidimensional and dynamic, changing directions in the face of dead ends and finding openings in the face of obstacles. On the one side was the seemingly impenetrable maze of the federal political system. On the other was the unpredictable reaction of the national media to the story of Japanese Canadians. In between, or more tellingly, at the heart of all the commotion were the many Japanese Canadians, whose response to past injustices hovered close to a potentially debilitating ambivalence. The most difficult obstacle in the first phase of the movement was their reluctance to actively remember, that is, to piece together the fragments of memory. It was at this juncture, I believe, that the phenomenon of house meetings was instrumental in mobilizing the call for redress. I chaired the Vancouver Japanese Canadian Citizens Association Redress Committee, the group responsible for the campaign in the Greater Vancouver area from 1984 to the settlement day. During 1984 and 1985, we arranged numerous house meetings. Held in private homes, they allowed small groups of relatives and friends to get together to share internment stories and to reflect on the implications of redress. I describe the impact of these gatherings in one section of my book, Redress, and I'll cite that passage. In one house meeting, an adult daughter is dumbfounded to learn that her mother had given birth to her in Hastings Park while confined in the filthy livestock buildings. Why had she not told her before? Her mother says she wanted to protect her daughter from that painful knowledge, but in the advent of redress, she feels she is able to disclose this element of her life. This instance is but one in a torrent of memories called forth by the redress movement. The unprecedented disruption of family unity cut deep into the consciousness of those uprooted. Mothers recounted the precise moment that their young sons had been shipped east to work in road camps. Many who were then children remembered, as if it were the day before, the shock of removal from their school, their education terminated as they went from being Canadian to becoming a figure of the Japanese race. There were memories of lonely and fearful train rides as women, children, and the elderly, without fathers and husbands, were sent to bleak ghost towns in the BC interior. Overnight, places like Slocan City, Sandon, New Denver, Popoff, and Lemon Creek became sites of incarceration, called relocation centers by the government. In fact, so much of the pain had been covered over by euphemisms, especially the term evacuation used by the government to identify what was in actuality internment and dispossession. In light of the stories emerging in the House meetings, I ask you to imagine the fragmented memories of many Japanese Canadians. They had been ripped from their homes, stripped of their rights, dispossessed, dispersed, and many of them were exiled from the country of their birth. Although government authorities, including the RCMP and the military, knew from evidence that the mass uprooting was not a bona fide security measure and that it reflected a capitulation to racist pressures in BC, decades had passed, and nothing official had been done to acknowledge the injustices. Without such public recognitions, Japanese Canadians continued to bear the stigma of being branded enemy aliens. Having undergone the pressure to assimilate, to become the model minority, they were still burdened by the emotional and psychic residue of internment. but how to move from here to there, from the condition of personal awareness to the House of Commons, the inner sanctum of the nation's power. The usual strategy, and unfortunately often perceived as the only one, is to retain a team of hotshot lawyers to construct a redress position. But the issue of redress was wrapped up in much more complicated matters than questions of legality alone. The internment had been authorized by the War Measures Act, an all-powerful act that allowed the government to indefinitely detain individuals and groups that were suspected of being a danger to the state. Many Japanese Canadians perceived this act as such an affront to their citizenship rights that they called for its expungement as part of any redress settlement. The act was, however, rescinded the year before, in 1987. But perhaps it has not disappeared completely. Some of its alarming traces have resurfaced in the language of the federal government's Anti-Terrorism Act of 2001, which gives agents of the law the authority to detain individuals without charging them with a crime, merely on the speculation that they may be associated with terrorist acts. For this reason, the case of Mir Arar, a Syrian-Canadian whose citizenship rights were violated when he was forcibly sent to Syria instead of being allowed to return to Canada, bears a striking similarity to the treatment of Japanese Canadians. In both instances, the right to a fair trial was denied. By using the War Measures Act to intern Japanese Canadians, the government, in fact, acted legally. Consequently, when the National Association of Japanese Canadians initiated redress as a political movement, they based their call for justice on the abuse of the War Measures Act. In other words, the government's policies may have been legal, but the effects of these policies, the dispossession, forced dispersal, and deportation of Japanese Canadians, far exceeded the norms of fairness and equal treatment under the law. Indeed, the violation of their rights on the basis of ascribed racial origin, being of the Japanese race, according to the government's definition, could not be defended as a necessary security measure. In addition, legal arguments in the case of Japanese Canadians would likely have been ineffectual. Or worse, their own accounts of internment could easily have been lost in the privileged language of law. By following the political route, the call for redress would involve more urgent questions of narrative, voice, and position, all the elements more familiar to cultural and literary theorists, like myself, than to lawyers. Shaping these elements took over 2 years as the NAJC worked to bring together a fragmented group of Japanese Canadians who lacked knowledge of political movements and who had to struggle against the temptation to remain silent. But more, the role of victim, often raised in the context of redress, especially by the national media, was rejected by many Japanese Canadians. Although they held the government accountable for their losses, they remained proud of the ways in which they managed to rebuild their lives and to retain their loyalty to the Canadian nation. This is why the language of citizenship struck such a resonant chord for them, confirming, as it did, their efforts over many decades to be Canadian. The abrogation of their citizenship rights, especially for the Nisei or the Canadian-born second generation, embodied the ultimate insult to their faith in democracy. This attitude became a critical component of the case for redress developed by the NAJC for its 1984 brief to the federal government. The brief spoke of the Canadian commitment to human rights and the sanctity of the democratic process, and it situated the issue of redress in the parliamentary system of responsibility towards its citizens. Instead of adopting the voice of victims who sought compensation for losses and damage, the language of law, it focused primarily on the democratic system itself. When the government wrongfully interned Japanese Canadians, the principles of democratic governance were betrayed in its actions. The brief that the NAJC issued on November 21, 1984, was called Democracy Betrayed, the Case for Redress. As I circle back to where I began with the current climate of globalization, I want to emphasize the crucial element of the NAJC's redress movement, the principle of a negotiated settlement. When the NAJC decided that Japanese Canadians needed to represent themselves and not speak through external mediators such as lawyers and professional lobbyists, its strategy committee was given the task of articulating and promoting the NAJC, a process that lasted for 4 intense years. In all, the strategy committee encountered 5 government ministers: Liberal David Colinette, 1984, and Conservatives Jack Murdaugh, 1984-85, Otto Jelinek, 1985-86, David Crombie, 1986-87, and finally Jerry Weiner, 1988. On many occasions, when we pressed for direct negotiations on redress, we were told by government administrators and politicians that such a process was beyond the scope of any possible action. The federal government, they said, consults but does not negotiate. Decisions are made by ministers after they have assessed an issue. From the perspective of Japanese Canadians, however, direct negotiations would ensure that a settlement would be based on the principle of individual and not merely group compensation. After all, by interning Japanese Canadians because of assumed race affiliations, the government had violated their individual rights. A settlement that did not recognize this principle would fall far short of our call for a just and fair settlement. And worse, from our perspective, the government's resistance to the negotiation process reminded us of the denial of voice in the 1940s. I can still clearly remember our ritual flights to Ottawa to stage resistances to the threat of an imposed settlement. For years, from the spring of 1984, first the Liberal government and then the Conservative government pressured the NAJC to accept a token settlement, something in the form of an institution or foundation in the 6 to 10 million range that would, quote, commemorate or, quote, memorialize the internment. Words that were important for the NAJC, such as redress, compensation, and negotiations, never found sympathetic ears in government circles, although the national press soon adopted the language of redress disseminated by the NAJC. One anecdote offers a flavor of the desperate trips to Ottawa we made in response to government threats to resolve redress without our approval. In January 1986, we had reached a stalemate with Multiculturalism Minister Otto Jelinek. He had adopted a no-nonsense, tough stance toward the NAJC, and for this reason, he was often dubbed the Rambo Minister. According to Jelinek, either we accept the token foundation in the name of Japanese Canadians, or we could expect nothing. As part of our Ottawa lobbying agenda, we met with Ed Broadbent, then leader of the NDP, and his caucus. Right in the midst of our discussion, an aide rushed in with a sheet announcing a forthcoming redress acknowledgement in the House of Commons. Had we been informed of this? When we said no, Broadbent was astounded. After reading the proposed acknowledgement, we then told him that its language had already been rejected outright by the NAJC as wholly inadequate in its representation of Japanese Canadian internment. When Broadbent emerged from our meeting to meet the press, he announced that the NDP would never endorse an approach to redress that was not acceptable to the NAJC. Although he did not take a position on negotiations at the time, his support, soon reinforced by the Liberal opposition, prevented what could have been a disastrous unilateral move by the government. The principle of negotiation became a touchstone for the movement. From the National Forum of Political Struggle to the nitty-gritty elements of personal and collective memory, we never stopped engaging in a process of negotiations. Nowhere was this process more revealing than in the massive body of archival documents and internment housed in Ottawa. There, in the inert and hidden papers from the past, were the voices of internment. And in a haunting way, at least for me, they seemed to be waiting to be heard. In light of the documents, events that had been shrouded in mystery, including government decisions that had dispossessed Japanese Canadians, were exposed as highly specific injustices. My own birth, 5 months after my family traveled by train from Haney, B.C., to the small French-Canadian town of St. Agathe, also contained a mystery. Why had my mother been alone when she gave birth? I'll never forget the late night in the archives, coming across the RCMP report on my mother. She alone had been given a pass to enter Winnipeg, and I found out that she had spent a week alone in a hostel waiting. The report noted that the population of interned Japanese Canadians increased by one on October the 10th. Here I did feel like a poet thief in the house of the nation who was able to steal information that could redress my mother's own silences. The poem of this moment was written soon after the settlement, but it recalls an earlier time. Set in the reading room of the National Archives, its language enacts a negotiation between the future and the haunted past. And I must give you this note, because you can't read the poem in print. I should mention that in the final lines of this poem, the first weight is spelt W-E-I-G-H-T. And the second weight is spelt W-A-I-T. The third one, I hope, will become obvious. And the poem is called Single File for My Mother, Who Was There. At the back of the library, the National, mind you, capital, quiet, archive, hush. Working wish, no distraction. The distillation, memory bank. Brittle paper folds, spare trees, snow covered outside. The bland report of the bus ride from St. Agathe, 1 week delay, alone in the hostel, putting in time for the birthday. Who said what and where is not there? Though the turning out of a son is unrecorded by name, nevertheless, the stat made its way to be documented and then stolen by me. Wait a go, don't let go. Wait a go, don't let go. Wait a go, don't let go. The 1988 redress settlement occurred at a crucial time in Canada. As the post-war nation in which Japanese Canadians had been incorporated as a model minority lost its coherence, the citizenship values that it had professed also lost their urgency. And in this manner, and the paradox still perplexes us, the affirmation of citizenship in the redress settlement came at a time that citizenship as a form of social and cultural allegiance was being undermined by the powerful forces of economic globalization. Now, along with economic globalization came its promotion of neoliberalism, an ideology that encourages self-interest as the value most conducive to the individual acquisition of financial and material gain. Almost overnight, the language of special rights replaced the language of the social contract in the country. Almost overnight, everyone was advised to become his or her own capitalist. Goodbye to company pensions, hello to portfolios. Goodbye to national industries, hello to transnational corporations. Goodbye to the public good, hello to privatization. Goodbye to cultural values, hello to cultural commodities. But now, in the new conditions of a post-9/11 world of global tensions, neoliberalism has begun to ring hollow. Marketplace values have shown themselves completely incapable of preventing warfare, mediating the threat of terrorism, and checking the power of the U.S. military. Unfettered economic globalization undermines the well-being of workers, the health of nations, and the future of the planet. In the face of an ominous confluence of rampant materialism and fundamentalist hatreds in the spaces of globalization, it has been heartening to see a turn to a rethinking of citizenship. Pivotal in this rethinking are critiques of the historical conditions in which destructive relations of power, resources, and voice were constituted. Once we recognize that the language of difference has produced systems of inclusion and exclusion, we can begin to address the question of redress as a form of mediation. of equal importance, and more so for our long-term efforts to construct new forms of democratic governance, the concept of redress helps to make visible the deeply subjective dimensions of personal and social traumas. As the pressure to redress past injustices mounts, as it does, for example, in Canada over native land claims and residential school abuse, there is more urgency to work through negotiation processes in which those directly affected are involved, not merely as recipients of state actions, but as active participants in the resolution process. I will end with a short piece from a poem about family called Flow, as in water. She gazed out the back window and saw her kids playing by the river. They were digging for something in the wet ground. Her youngest one was sleeping on the veranda. The sun warmed her face, almost soothing. She thought of what to make for supper and what winter would bring in this house. Thank you very much.
Roy Meakey, Multiculturalism Lecturer for 2005, finishing his talk in the Chan Center on the campus of the University of British Columbia. I'm Paul Kennedy. You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1. After his lecture, Roy Meakey graciously agreed to answer questions from the audience.
Hi, my name is Jenny from Rice Paper Magazine. I'd really like to thank you for the talk that you gave this evening. But as a young Japanese-Canadian who has also talked with, I guess, many Chinese-Canadians with regard to both the Japanese-Canadian redress and the ongoing Chinese head tax redress, in your opinion, what do you think is the role of the youth to carry out these kind of redressing of injustices? Because myself personally, my parents came after the internment. They were not personally interned, so we feel a sense of, at least I do, lack of legitimacy when we go on talking about these kind of issues. Mm-hmm.
That's an excellent question. I cannot speak for the youth. the youth should speak for the youth. You know, I think the current issues that we're facing today around global governance and around the effects of commodity capitalism and I call it the rampant materialism of our lives, is calling for different models of coexistence and different models of thinking through human injustices, right? And so from that perspective, there's a whole universe to reinvent. So it's not a matter of going back in the past and digging and rooting around in that, but it's a matter of starting where you are. And we live in a post-redress world. Redress now functions not according to the way it did in the past, but it functions now as a part of a public space where it's part of the history of recent political action. So that's how you take it. You take it from where you're receiving it, and then you remake it. And you remake it in whatever terms that you think make sense to you. But somebody can't tell you what to do. Eventually, the urgencies of living a more humane life may kick in, and you'll want to create that world yourself.
Thank you very much for your presentation. I had the privilege of working with the Nisei and Issei congregation at the same time. And one of the things I found both for them and for myself is that the difficulty of the parents sharing with their children the tough experiences of their life. They told the good stories, but not the difficult ones. And so when the young people tried to understand, they couldn't cope with that generation gap. And I think we find it today among every cultural group and immigrant community that the youth and the adults are not conveying to each other the whole story, so that when they try to do redress or correct wrongs, they don't have the actual information because it hasn't even been shared across the kitchen table. Seems to me you've highlighted a need for us as individuals in our own families to be able to share with one another what we'd like to first share with the public, and I'd be interested in your comment in that for helping all of us in our cultural groups to move ahead and learn to live with each other in a new way.
I don't think I need to really comment. I thought that was pretty clearly enough stated. I agree with you. You know, there's not that much time, but that's very well articulated. Thank you.
Hi, Todd Wong from gonghagisphatchoy.com. I'm currently blogging the One Book, One Vancouver events, as well as Gim Wong's Ride for Redress across Canada. And I'm wondering that as an English professor, when Obasan came out, and to have Joy Kagawa's Naomi's Road turned into an opera, that was great music this evening, by the way. I'm wondering, what does that mean culturally to us as a nation to have these events become part of our cultural fabric? And does the Chinese community need to try and find, you know, those kind of literary legends on which to build redress? Does it make a difference?
Well, you know, I think in the Japanese-Canadian community, we have been pretty lucky, and I think I've shared in that luck with a generation of artists and writers who did come out and get involved in redress. And some of us artists and writers actually got involved in the politics as an artistic act. And we saw the participation as a part and process of our art. So we've been fairly fortunate in that respect. I can't really speak for Chinese-Canadian writers, but I have great admiration for all of the work that's come out in the last 15 years from Chinese-Canadian writers in the anthologies and novels and so on. So there is just a proliferation of new work coming out by Asian-Canadian writers, and I identify myself more and more now as an Asian-Canadian writer, because being Japanese-Canadian, yes, it's important, but it's also a limit. And to see ourselves within a broader and broader communities, I think, is really important. So I'm not answering your question, but yeah, I think you know the answer. It's, of course, it'll help if you create the stories that frame your history and that make it possible for people to converse with each other around that history through the stories. You're obviously going to build community.
Roy Meakey, multiculturalism lecturer for 2005, speaking recently on the campus of the University of British Columbia. The multiculturalism lecture is co-sponsored by UBC, IDEAS, and the Laurier Institution. Tonight's broadcast was produced by Bernie Lucht with recording engineer Chris Cutress. You can buy an audio copy of tonight's program for $18, taxes and shipping included. To order using a credit card, call area code 416-205-7367. Or you can send a check or credit card information for $18 to IDEAS Transcripts, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Our e-address is ideas@cbc.ca. The executive producer of IDEAS is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 for the hourly news, followed by the Arts Tonight and Between the Covers.